Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
We're back at Viet History Makers with Kevin Pham, my co-host. Today, we are doing part two of Ho Chi Minh.
How do you feel, Ken?
We talked about a few weeks ago how we have to be careful with how we present information and how we talk about certain things. And I'm feeling kind of good about, I think, episode one. I had some time to think about it. And I think that we are open to hearing comments, and we would love for people to leave their comments and thoughts in the comment section. We also would love to have some support. This is some hard work, Kevin, and I know that you have put a lot of elbow grease into making sure that we are brought some really good information.
Thank you for that. But yes, it does take time and work to do this on top of my job as a professor. I work on these in a cafe. I write them out. So if you want to buy me a coffee, that would be much appreciated. So let's jump into it. Me playing the role of professor, Ken the student. And as professor, I'm going to really quickly recap what we did in our last episode. So in part one, what we did is we discussed Ho Chi Minh's diagnosis of the problem. Now, think of Ho Chi Minh as kind of he sees himself as sort of a doctor. You know, he's going to diagnose the problems confronting the Vietnamese people, and he's going to offer a prescription. He's going to give what is the proper medicine that the Vietnamese should take. So in part one, we did the diagnosis. Today in part two, we're going to do the medicine. So, okay, what was the diagnosis of the problem? For Ho Chi Minh, he thought that the problem is, simply put, private ownership of the means of production for private profit. There's a name for this. It's called capitalism. And it's really from capitalism that we get colonialism and racism, he thinks, because colonialism and racist dehumanization is simply the logic of capitalist exploitation. So capitalists are people who own the means of production, and their goal is profit. And so for them, they need to expand their market, including overseas. And to exploit workers, it's helpful to see them as racially inferior. Okay, so Ho Chi Minh is going to pick up these ideas, these Marxist ideas, when he's in France, when he's traveling around. We talked in the last episode about his relations with the French socialists, how he helped found the French Communist Party, and how he was changed by reading Lenin, okay? So that's what we did in part one. Now in part two, today we're going to discuss his prescription for what he thinks the Vietnamese should do, okay? What we're gonna, yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to introduce and interrupt, because I've had these conversations with people about this idea of the inferior group of people. And I brought this up at dinner with other people, and a lot of people says the Vietnamese at the time were inferior. And it was good that the French did come in, even under those circumstances, to put people, enslave the workers. And ultimately, the byproduct was Vietnam leveled up a little bit. How do we answer that?
Just to be clear here, are you telling me that you've met people who said it's good that the Vietnamese were exploited in rubber plantations, worked 17 hours a day, and killed, and that was good?
There were our people that really believed that the exchange of that, you know, they go, yes, that was a very bad thing. They agree. That's a very bad thing. And I'm playing devil's advocate here. But ultimately, we came out ahead of where we, as mm-hmm. Vietnamese people, we had buildings built, we had more technology in the country, we had a hierarchy, monarchy was out. You know, they attributed all these great things to the French. And when we think about capitalism, you and I can really, you know, take a 30,000 foot, you know, observation about this. But I get pushback sometimes with older people saying, you know, it's just part of leveling up. You know, that's what they did back then. And, you know, we just have to put ourselves in the context of the time. You know, we needed that. What do we say to that?
This is actually really interesting because you can kind of take this one of two ways. You could actually fit this argument into a Marxist narrative. It's the breaking a few eggs to make an omelet argument, yeah. where the argument is that history moves in stages. So societies change their economic relations go through stages. And so the argument is that after you need capitalism and then it paves the ground for communism. So you might make that argument. But another argument there is one that's justifying colonialism, that these are backwards peoples. And so we need, quote unquote, civilized people to go in there and to help bring them along. Now, the problem with that argument is the question of, well, okay, when can those so-called backwards peoples govern themselves? At what point, you know, would you know when to leave?
Yeah.
And so actually, historically, during the period of decolonization in the 60s, many in Europe saw that as evidence of the success of European colonialism, because they were like, look, we helped them out for decades, and now they are ready to govern themselves. So I think that's very interesting. But for Ho Chi Minh, he's going to say, the French exploited our labor, dehumanized us, and the solution now is communist revolution. And so that's what we're going to do today. We're going to discuss what his prescription was, okay? But I'm glad you brought that up. That's really interesting. So we are going to focus on what Ho Chi Minh said, what his ideas were, what were his goals. So what did he think the Vietnamese should do? What was his plan for doing revolution and for building a new Vietnamese society? In short, what was his political vision? I'm going to call it his political theory. What was his political theory? So I'm going to explain what his political theory was, and then I'm going to point out what I think are some problems with it. Again, however, all political theories, I think, have problems of their own. But today I'm going to point that out. Now, Ken, what I want to do before we get into this, one thing I really want to talk about is that, okay, I just said that we're going to focus on what he said himself, what he said in his speeches and writings. And of course, some people are going to argue, well, sure, he might have said good things, but why should we care about what he said? We should look at what he did. And there's a very famous saying that I hear all the time from anti-communist South Vietnamese in the diaspora. My dad says it all the time. And I think Nguyen Van Thieu said, actually was the one who said this saying, which you probably have heard too, but it's "Đừng nghe những gì Cộng sản nói." Hãy nhìn những gì Cộng sản làm, okay? Don't listen to what the communists say, but look at what the communists do. And I really want to address this because, to me, there seems to be two pretty obvious responses that one can give, and it seems like no one brings them up. So I want to bring them up and briefly talk about this with you. So first, here's how I would respond. Yes. We should absolutely look at what the Vietnamese Communist Party did in real life. But you have to realize that the Communist Party, the Vietnamese Communist Party, has existed since 1930. That's almost 100 years. And in that time, they've done a lot of different things. And so Which things do you want to focus on, right? Yeah. And one's interpretation of whether those facts are good or bad will depend on one's perspective and position. Like, that seems obvious to me. For example, so-called re-education camps, or what my dad would call hard labor camps. For South Vietnamese veterans, they were torture. They were inhumane. They were evil. It was hell. It was tyranny. My mother's father died of malnutrition in one. My father's father was in one. But for someone on the communist side, they might agree that torture is wrong, but they would probably say that that's the fault of the individual guard in the camp who did it, right? This doesn't mean that the idea of communism is wrong. So for them, re-education camps are a form of mercy, of clemency. It's actually giving human rights, a second chance, right, to those who sinned and to come back to the nation. So that's their perspective. Look at land reforms of the 1950s, taking land from landlords, giving it to peasants. Of course, this is horrible and bad if you're a landlord, but if you're a peasant, you would say it's good. So it depends on perspective. And those are simple things I want to say, but another thing is that the things that they did do are a mix, I think, of bad and good. So there's the bad. So after the war, the Communist Party made anyone associated with South Vietnam second-class citizens. I mean, let's say that, right? It was hard to get a good job. I knew a man who was a commander in the South Vietnamese army, but after the war, he could only find work as a cyclo driver.
Yeah, like, many of that was
many, many of them, right? And it's not just them, but their children as well. So it's hard to get accepted to a university if the children's parents were on the
side. It wasn't hard. It wasn't hard to get accepted to a university. It was impossible to get it accepted.
Impossible.
It was impossible. Yeah, it wasn't hard. It was just you could. There was no shot. If you were branded Nguyen, which is traitor, you were not given. There's no way you could get. You could be upwardly mobile in society.
Right, right. And there's also corruption, bribery. At the same time, I think it's undeniable that things are changing all the time. So in 2011, when I lived in Vietnam, it was conventional to put $20 in your passport to get through security at the airport quickly. Today, you can't do that today. Like, today, you would not do that, okay? And also, lack of freedom of speech. I mean, there's no denying that there is arresting, jailing of bloggers. And this is bad from the perspective of someone who values freedom of speech. It's a violation of human rights. At the same time, for someone else who values national security, they would say, yeah, people should not destabilize a country with harmful ideas. And under the leadership of the Vietnamese Communist Party, and I had talked about this in a past episode, I think it's undeniable that there are some positives here ever since 1986, at least, right? So Vietnam has tripled GDP per capita between 2002, 2018, lifted 45 million out of poverty, has the highest life expectancy in the region. So this is significant. So all I'm trying to say is that if you say, look at what the communists did, not what they say, even if you look at what they did, there's so much that they did that you have to be specific, okay? And so you have to look at a lot of things. Now, second, there's another response that I have to that phrase, which is you should actually look at what they say, especially if you're anti-communist, actually. Because, look, let's say you are sympathetic to communism, then you would naturally want to know their ideas. But if you're anti-communist, you need to know what you're up against, right? You need to know your enemy. You need to be able to reconstruct the arguments of your enemy so that you can challenge it effectively if you want to. You need to say what their ideas are and then show why they're wrong and why you're right. So that's why you should care about what they say. So that was a...
You and I think are... This is a daring exercise because I don't think that this is common to talk about these things. This is a very mucky, very yucky area, I think, in the history of Vietnamese people in Vietnam and Vietnamese Americans overseas. You know, there's constantly online debates about this allegiance to the different sides. And We're just here really to explore it and be as open-minded as possible without getting, you know, without getting the details wrong, hopefully. I just want to bring up the things you talked about earlier, which is what seems to me in the work that I've done in the last few years is like the two biggest things you brought up first is the re-education camps and the land reform. I think people within the party even have issues with how that went down. People in the party in France, in the Communist Party that were Vietnamese people that left in the 60s, also had a problem with it when it got to the 80s and 90s and they left the Communist Party. I think land reform, when I think about America now and all the billionaires, and I think about how unfair it is that these billionaires have so much money, I would love to see them give back and force them to give back. It kind of makes me sympathetic to that, you know, taking from the rich and giving to the poor, because there were really, really poor people in that era that, again, if we live contextually in that historical period, we would understand how really poor people were affected by big landowners. And so these things are things that we're so removed from those times that I don't think that we can really grasp it fully when we think about these landowners and rich people and billionaires, you know, in of that time being persecuted and robbed of their property and land.
Look, I'm not going to beat around the bush. One thing that everybody can do is they can go to this website where they can visualize Jeff Bezos's wealth on the screen. Like a tiny square is $90,000, maybe the income of a family. And then all the orange is the wealth that he has. And you can scroll for hours and that tiny dot is long gone and it's just a sea of orange. I remember my friend saw that. She said it really bothered her for days. It made her furious, man.
If you think about the mechanics and the leverage of capitalism, ultimately, there are late stages of capitalism. And what does that mean? Late stages means that eventually you get leveraged, all the poor people get leveraged out of money and land and power. It goes to one side if it's unbridled, if it's unprotected. And I think that's the nuanced conversation that people don't really think about. We are in late stages of capitalism where it is becoming a very weird and odd place that we're living in, is that because all these things are in place, the laws and the way that capitalism works, it becomes funneled into, you know, concentrated into very rich people. And we don't think of that often. You know, in the 1950s, America had a very beautiful spreading out of the rise of the middle class with the industrialization, Henry Ford, and being able to kind of like everybody almost being, you know, having all this opportunity to buy homes and cars. And it is very different today. And I think that's something that if we think about the land reform of the communists and the Viet Minh of the era, they were probably experiencing that sort of that taking of the French and Vietnamese rich people of the time. And that's where the revolt happened.
Yeah, yeah. And the big question is, I think a lot of people can agree on massive inequality is bad. Now, not everybody will agree. Some people will say, well, it's good that billionaires are there and so on. But I think a lot of people will agree that there's something wrong with this. Now, where people will disagree is, what do you do, right?
Yeah,
that's the hard part. What's the
and this is, I think, the really what we're focusing on with Ho Chi Minh and perhaps the people we talk about after Ho Chi Minh is sort of what went wrong or what did they do right?
Yeah. Okay, good. So let me now give some very quick historical context, and then we'll discuss some what I would say are a few key tenets of Ho Chi Minh's political theory. Okay, history. So 1941, Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, and this brings the United States into World War II. Now, at this time, the Vietnamese people are especially the anti-colonial Vietnamese, are hopeful that the U.S. will beat Japan, right? Many of them do not like Japan occupying Vietnam. So many Vietnamese are looking at positively at the United States. In that same year, Ho Chi Minh returns. He goes to the north of Vietnam. And so Ho Chi Minh at this time, he's actually going to downplay communism. And he's going to appear more nationalistic because what he wants to do is he wants to create a united front against colonialism. So it doesn't matter if you're a communist or anti-communist, if you're against the French, join the Viet Minh. So in 1943, Ho Chi Minh asked the United States, hey, can you partner up with us to fight Japan? And so by 1945, as we know, World War II comes to an end and Japan loses, right? And so they overthrow the French government in Indochina. And this is when Vietnamese revolutionaries take advantage of this power vacuum and the Viet Minh seizes control. This is the August Revolution. And so in August, the Viet Minh, they take control of major cities in the whole country, north, middle, and south. And we talked in this in our episode about Bao Dai, but Bao Dai reluctantly gives power to the Viet Minh. So this is, and then September 2nd, 1945, Ho Chi Minh declares independence. And did we talk about this the last episode? But he begins the Declaration of Independence by quoting from the United States Declaration of Independence.
I don't think we talked about that.
Oh, we didn't. Wow. Okay, yeah.
So it could be wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, Professor, why don't we go review this again, this chapter?
Yeah. So he begins by literally translating the American Declaration of Independence into Vietnamese. You could actually listen to this online, the quote, the speech. And right after that, he then quotes the French Declaration of the Rights of the Man and the Citizen. So from both the French and the American revolutions. And then Ho Chi Minh says, these are words from the French and American revolutions. We believe in them too. And then he goes on to list a long list, a train of abuses, you might say, that the French government has done, right? They've taxed us here. They've done this. They've done that. If any of you have read the Declaration of Independence of the United States, and if you're an American, you absolutely should, it's exactly the same thing what Ho Chi Minh does. It's a list of all the bad things. And this is really important because to philosophers like John Locke, where the founding fathers, the American founding fathers, get a lot of their ideas, John Locke says, it's not okay to just do a revolution if your government's being bad. You actually need to show how the government is being bad over a long period of time. Like, you can't just, like, revolution is a serious thing. You need to show how the government is not reforming and so on and so on. So that's what Ho Chi Minh does. He creates this Declaration of Independence justifying Vietnamese revolution. And here, it's interesting to say that in his Declaration of Independence, he doesn't really talk about communism. He sounds much more like a nationalist. But one thing that I want to say is that there used to be a debate, was Ho Chi Minh a communist more than he was a nationalist, or was he a nationalist more than he was a communist? And I do think that this debate has been settled, and it's been settled with a book published in 2016. It's called Vietnam's Communist Revolution, and the author is Dung Vu. And it's not just Dung Vu saying this, it's other scholars of Vietnam like Pierre Asselin. And so they are essentially saying Ho Chi Minh was through and through a believer in international communist revolution, world revolution. And they use him and the other leaders in the Communist Party used nationalism to carry out a worldwide communist revolution. Now, this is really interesting because the implications here is that the Americans who were pro-Vietnam War, that's what they were arguing. And the Americans who were peace-loving and wanted the U.S. to withdraw, they were the ones saying that, no, the Vietnamese communists aren't really communists, they're really nationalists. And so now you get into this awkward situation where essentially the war hawks are being vindicated. But of course, if you're a communist, you would like that. You would say like, oh yes, Ho Chi Minh really was a communist. Do you know what I mean?
You know, there's two things that I'm thinking in my mind.
Yeah.
Before a major flip in the government or a revolution, there's this idea that we need to overthrow the billionaires, the ruling class, right? We need to take over. But the second part that I think distinction is like, okay, well, once you take over, the ruling of it, the governmental side of it, the way things are orchestrated and ran, I think that's the part that's very difficult for, I think, Vietnamese American diaspora people is like, okay, we might be able to agree that, yeah, you need to overthrow the ruling French, the people who are like colonizing you. Okay. And how that gets done, it might be bloody. We can probably agree and come to the table and say, okay, we needed to do that. But I think the hard part, and we're not going to get into it today, but I just like to plant the seeds for our audience that is probably the hard part to chew on. The hard part to digest is that how do you rule after you've already taken over? And I think that's where I think the debate and the mucky area of Ho Chi Minh and the people that came after is the thing that we often are unhappy about in the diaspora.
Exactly, because the question becomes, what are you going to replace the old rulers with? Are you going to go back to what you had before? Are you going to have a monarchy before? Or are you going to have something new? Are you going to have a parliamentary democracy,
yep,
a liberal democracy? Or are you, what kind of system are you going to have? Who is going to have power? This is exactly the question on every revolutionary's mind. So they have a clear vision, though a revolutionary has a clear vision of what to replace it with, and it's going to be something very different from before. So Ho Chi Minh is a revolutionary, meaning he has a vision to radically change Vietnamese society away from monarchy, away from colonial capitalism. His vision, and I have a name for it, I made this name up, this is what I'm going to call it, and I'm going to say what I mean by it. I call his vision, and this is a theory of revolution, I call his vision paternalistic democracy. And here's what I mean. Listener, you got to stick with me here, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's paternalistic because Ho Chi Minh clearly believed that the Communist Party, the leaders, should act as the people's parents. The masses of Vietnamese people are similar to undeveloped children. They're not so educated. They're in many ways ignorant. They are in need of moral guidance, in need of political guidance. And the Communist Party is supposed to be wiser, more virtuous, and they're supposed to guide the masses. So that's why it's paternalistic. It's like a parent, right? Party's the parents, people, the masses are the children.
Very Confucian to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're going to get there. So the Communist Party must be good parents, and in order to be good parents, they have to cultivate what Ho Chi Minh calls Đạo đức cách mạng, revolutionary morality, through a method that he calls criticism and self-criticism. We're going to talk about this. And only then could the people be guided towards the socialist project. Now, that's the paternalism of it. How is it democratic at all, right? So at the same time, Ho Chi Minh thinks that this is democratic because even though the government is the parents and the people are the children, the government is really the servant of the people who are the masters of the country. He's always saying that. The people are the zhou. They are the masters, the owners of the country. And so everything that is done, it's done for the people. They are the most precious. So there you go. It's like the people are masters who are children, children masters. Ken, does this sound like a contradiction or not? Do you think it could not be?
I think in theory, it would be right. In theory, but the practical application is children have natural moral compass that often collides with parents and older people. And I think older people sometimes have a lot more experience, and sometimes the means justify the ends. And what I mean by that is, because you've lived as a parent for a lot longer than your kids, sometimes you, in your own brain, authorize decisions that ignore what a child might be wanting or thinking based on the benefits in the future for them. And I think that when we as older people declare that we know more than the children, that is where things start to go weird and haywire. But it's very difficult to kind of balance what adults know versus what children's natural moral compasses. You know, I get questioned by my kids all the time, why do you do that? Why do you do that? And I know I'm clearly wrong. So I have to be honest with them. And I have to take a very brave approach and courageous approach to say, you know what? I am wrong. You're right. You're right by calling me out. And I give you the keys to my moral compass now. You can call me out, and you should call me out. But that's decades of living in both the Confucian world with my mom and dad, and living in American world where, you know, we can't take it too far with Americans take it too far. And I think Vietnamese people from a previous generation with the Confucian ideas take it too far. So I'm going to boast and say, I think my way is the best way, because I can take both of these systems and really integrate it into the way I live my life. And I think it's, for me, I think it's the right way to do it. But it's hard to get parents to do that.
This is great, because this is a perfect segue into the next few points that I want to make. Just to organize this conversation for the listeners, the three things I want to touch on is, number one, Confucianism and Leninism. So that's one aspect of Ho Chi Minh's thought. His anti-individualism, that's another. And his notion of democracy as dictatorship of the proletariat. We're going to go through this. So Confucianism and Leninism, Ho Chi Minh sees these as perfectly compatible, because what Lenin emphasized was the need for a vanguard, the need for a professional class of revolutionaries. The idea was that the masses of people will never do revolution on their own. They can never. If you leave workers alone, the best that they could come to is maybe trade union consciousness, according to Lenin. So he's going to say you actually need intellectuals, you need smart revolutionaries who are trained to lead the people. And this idea of leading the people through leaders is also very Confucian. So for Confucius, the duty of the government is to look after the people. That's like a parent, exactly what you were talking about. And at no point should the people be consulted about how this should be done. You should never ask your children, hey, how should I rule you? That is not Confucian. However, and this is really important, there is a Confucian tradition of remonstrance. So you should actually listen to your children. You need to ask how they're feeling. You need to figure out what their needs are. You do really need to listen to them all the time. That's being a good Confucian ruler. But you never take their advice. You listen to what they need, and they tell you their complaints. And then you have to care for them, but you don't let them tell you how to rule them. Do you know what I mean?
You know, and from what little I know about the present communist government, I feel like they do try to do that, you know, but I think within structures, there's always corruption and bribery. And, you know, there's bad actors in every government. And in the United States, we experience all of that, you know, but I think, you know, there's absolute power coming from that sort of brand of government ideal in Vietnam.
You know, Ken, like lately I've been reading a lot of Chinese political thought, like from the ancient periods, like from the Zhou period and the Warring States. And I've been reading about Maoism and Confucianism and legalism. And I got to say that anyone out there who's listening that's interested in Vietnamese political thinking and ways of governing, you have to start with Chinese political thought. Because as I read this stuff, as I read Chinese thought, I'm like, oh my God, this is exactly, everything is making sense now. Ho Chi Minh was a Confucian, but he was also a Moist. I don't want to get into all this, but by the way, I said that the other night to a Vietnamese person, and she said, yeah, you're right, but don't ever let a Chinese person know, because they're going to take all the credit, you know, like...
I have these debates all the time about where do we draw the line in the history of Vietnam's 4,000 years. You know, at what point were we, you know, cut off from the language and the thinking of the Chinese and became Vietnamese, right? That's like a big, I'm searching for that constantly in my life, because I think that it's kind of weird that Vietnamese people everywhere, not just in Vietnam, always says, you know, we fought to break out from Chinese, but the language was still the same. The culture, the thought, the thinking.
The political systems, the philosophy, a lot was... So, okay, here at this point, I want to talk about Ho Chi Minh's thoughts on revolution. So Ho Chi Minh says, he says, quote, to make a revolution, remold the soul first. To renovate society, renovate the self first. This is... Like, when I say that, Ken, what's your reaction to that? Does that make sense? Do you agree with that?
It does, but how many... The problem is, how much checking can I do to myself? How much can I stay within the confines of dignity or confines of morality and ethics? How much can I self-govern? That's a tricky question.
That's a great question. Now, that quote that I just said is really interesting because, number one, it goes against Orthodox Marxism, because for Marx and Lenin, they didn't say anything about morality, about the need to change yourself in order to do revolution. For Marx and Engels, they believed that revolution was, in a sense, like a law of history, like it would just kind of happen scientifically. If you oppress people enough, they're going to get angry, and then they're going to come together, they're going to revolt, and it's going to give... Like, they didn't say, oh, you need to change your character and you build virtue. For them, any change in morality and character would happen after you change the economic relations of society. So it happens downstream. But Ho Chi Minh's reversing it. He says, if you want to change society, you actually need to change your character first. So that's one new and interesting Confucian twist that he brings to Marxism that I think is quite new. So for Ho Chi Minh, like all many Confucians, like Ken, you must also be familiar. I think all Vietnamese are familiar with this, but it comes from the Confucian Book of Great Learning, but it's basically a formula that says, if you change yourself, if you improve yourself morally, then you automatically change your family. Then if so, you automatically change your society. Then you automatically change your country. And then you automatically change your world. Like it is a...
Yeah, there's a proverb for that in Vietnamese. I can't... It actually says it in very like eight syllables.
Yeah, exactly. It's
You can't rule the world if you can't rule your family, if you can't rule yourself. Yeah, it goes back to all of that. But there's a there's a cayao for that.
Yeah. I'm embarrassed. I can't remember it now. But yes, every educated Vietnamese knows this.
We'll break that cayao
for me, right?
And me too.
Yeah. But it's not, this is really from the Confucian Book of Great Learning, and it's this cause and effect thing. And so that was the theory that Ho Chi Minh adopted. And so he says, to become a true revolutionary, you need to focus on the four words of industry, gun, thrift, giam, integrity, liam, and righteousness, jin. So he's going to say that these are revolutionary virtues, essentially. He also talks about other virtues, so humaneness, nyan. Again, righteousness, nghĩa, knowledge, ji, courage, zung, and integrity, liam. So he says all of this together is essentially revolutionary morality. So if anyone knows about Confucianism, these are Confucian ideas. Now, he says if the Communist Party leaders want to be loved by the people, if they want to win the hearts of the people, they have to benefit the people. And they have to avoid anything that harms the people, okay? All right, now at this point, listeners are going to remember Phan Chu Trinh, our episode on Phan Chu Trinh. What Phan Chu Trinh was trying to do was marry Confucianism with liberalism. But Ho Chi Minh is going to marry Confucianism with Marxism and Leninism. So Ho Chi Minh says, and I'm going to quote, "To our Vietnamese people, we should self-rectify our mind by reading Confucius's works, and with respect to revolution, read Lenin's works." Okay. And this is important because French colonialism had poisoned our people by alcohol and opium. They used any trick to corrupt our nation by bad habits like laziness, artfulness, embezzling, and others. It's our responsibility to re-educate our people. Again, to re-educate our people, this is what party members need to do. He says, quote, "We need to induce our people to become courageous, patriotic, and industrious, fit for the independent Vietnam." So, okay, notice that the people are like children. They need to be re-educated. Do you agree with this, Ken?
I mean, yeah. I mean, we could never have enough re-educating on ourselves. We can never have enough working on ourselves. So, yeah, I do agree with that, you know, in some way. But again, all of this is relative and contextual. Like, how much do we need to work on ourselves as a normal person in society where the government or our elders are saying, oh, that's enough. That's good enough, right? Like, where's the line?
Yeah. Yeah. And so this brings us to the second point that I want to make, which is Ho Chi Minh is really anti-individualist. He thinks that's the biggest poison to any revolution. Zhong Nie, Gan Nhân, individualism. So to get rid of individualism, he thinks, you need to engage in criticism and self-criticism. You need to criticize yourself constantly. This is a very, very well-known communist revolutionary technique. It's created by Stalin, and Mao Zedong popularizes it. So the idea is that every day you tell yourself in front of people, or you tell people the mistakes you made as a revolutionary. So I was reading this memoir. It's by a French anthropologist, and he was kidnapped by the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And he was able to witness one of these sessions where they had the communist leader standing in front and the Communist Party members sitting down. And then he's like, okay, who's going to criticize themselves today? And one guy goes, okay, I'll go. I was a bad revolutionary. Yesterday, I was lazy, so I forgot to take in everybody's clothes when I did the laundry. So I left them outside, and they got wet, which delayed time for us. I won't do it again. And so the commander goes, okay, satisfactory. And then this is really interesting. He's expecting somebody else to volunteer the criticism. And what does he do? He looks at them. He looks at somebody, and he just goes like this. Like, he points at them with his lips. I think that's really interesting because he doesn't point with his fingers because you need it to be voluntary. You need people to volunteer the criticism. You can't make it look like you're forcing them. But also, pointing is probably rude in some cultures too. But still, the point is that you need to volunteer criticism. Now, one criticism of this practice that I have is, what if you don't volunteer? Like, what if you think you're a good revolutionary? And then if you don't volunteer, then somebody's going to be like, oh, Kevin thinks he's a better revolutionary than all of us, you know? And this later on, Nguyen Minh Tung or other Vietnamese are going to say that what this produces is fakeness, that people will start lying about their own criticisms. And so then they stop being sincere. But Ho Chi Minh always kept saying that all self-criticism must be sincere. It's like going to the doctor and like purifying yourself. It's a ritual of purification, in a sense. It's like Catholic confession, kind of. But the difference, though, is that it's public. It's not like private between priest and you, but it's like in front of everybody.
You know, a lot of these ideas are half-baked. And there's no way to fully bake them. You know, this idea of like everybody should make the same amount of money. Everybody should be equal in society.
No, I have to stop you there. So I do think this is a misconception of communist ideology. I think it's a very big misconception.
And I'm being very like the general population. That's sort
yeah,
of,
yeah, yeah. This is great.
What we all understand of communism and what we think communism is that like everybody has to be equal. I'm a doctor. I only make $400 a month.
No. Right? Okay. This is good that you're bringing this up. And let me clarify this for everyone. Lenin believed, so rewind back to Marx. Marx was good at criticizing and critiquing and explaining capitalism. He actually did not have much to say at all about how to build a communist society or how to manage a socialist economy. Marx did not, he didn't have much to say. So this is why Lenin is important, because Lenin's going to come in and he's going to give a much longer answer to how can we bring about communist revolution, according to Lenin, okay? Now, that's why there are people who call themselves Leninists, because they agree with Lenin. What Lenin argued was that you have two stages of communism, a higher stage and a lower stage. You need the lower stage before you get to the higher stage. And he's going to give names to these two stages. The lower stage of communism, he's going to call socialism. This is when the state takes control of the economy, when production and the means of production are centered into the state, which claims to act on behalf of the people. Okay? At this point in history, if you work a lot, you get paid a lot. If you work a little bit, you get paid a little bit. That is the principle. And so the slogan here is from each according to their ability, to each according to their contribution. That is not the slogan of communism, which is the later stage. And that slogan will be from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. So Lenin believed that first you need a strong state where you have this socialist principle. And he believed that that's the opposite of capitalism, because in capitalism, you have people who are barely working, but they make a ton of money. And you have people who are working a lot and they make very little money. But in socialism, it's the opposite. You work a lot, you get paid a lot. Work a little, you get paid a little. That was the idea. And then he believed that the state would eventually wither away once people become accustomed to this. And then you would have a communist society, which is the ultimate form of society, which is basically a classless society where everyone would kind of be working as if it's a big family. You know, like I cook for my family during the pandemic. I loved cooking for my family. I'm working. And it's because I love my family. I'm laboring for my family. And I do it voluntarily. And so Lenin believed that we would eventually reach that world. He never really said how long it would take, but that was the theory there. So I just want to clear that up, that the idea is that it's not that everyone is fine, like equality of outcome. I think that's the name that people... Marx and Engels never said anything about equality of outcome ever. Never. In fact, they thought equality in that sense was a total bourgeois, ridiculous idea. So this idea that communists want everybody to get paid the exact same thing, that's not at all to be found in Marx. And if anybody could find it in Marx, please tell me. Like, you'll become famous for discovering some. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, thank you for clarifying that. I think for the most part, I think I was raised with that sort of like thought, you know, that everybody should be equal. But there's a nuanced conversation there that we rarely talk about.
Yeah. Okay. I want to go one last point, which is this idea of democracy according to Ho Chi Minh. And then I want to talk about how these ideas could be problematic. Okay. Democracy. When you think of democracy, what do you think of, Ken? What is democracy?
Everybody gets to vote, and the majority gets to sway the rules.
Okay, good. That's actually not far from, you tell me if this is far. So dictatorship of the proletariat. This is the slogan for communist revolutionaries. This is what democracy is for them. What they mean by dictatorship of the proletariat is that it's democracy for the people, for the masses of the people, no democracy for the rich. So it's simultaneous. While you have democracy for the people, you are dictatorial with counter-revolutionaries or those people who sabotage the people's interests. So you suppress them. And those are going to be small in number. So they are, you suppress that minority, essentially. They are the capitalists, they are the bourgeoisie, they are the enemies of the people. You don't give them any democracy, but you give the masses democracy. So this is what's called dictatorship of the proletariat. I think that's pretty easy to understand. And this was Ho Chi Minh's idea. You need to serve the people. You need to fight the people's enemies. Do you agree with that, Ken?
I mean, it's beautiful to think like that. It's kind of interesting to, like, you know, have it in theory. But I think when you really boil down the practical application of it, it's not going to work, because really smart, hardworking people make a lot of money. And they are usually the people that are capable of making decisions and become government people or affect government people. They're friends of the government. And they ultimately are the ones that somehow find a way to lobby their wants and needs to become more rich. And I think that's the problem. That's the real practical issue that we have when we have that disconnect of this theory.
Yeah, I think that's one problem. Another is that, well, okay, serve the people, fight the people's enemies, but who's the enemy and how can you tell, right? You might accidentally call somebody an enemy when really they're not, and you might falsely accuse innocent people. This is exactly what happened with the French Revolution. You had the Terror, where people were sent to get their heads chopped off with no trial. Like, you know, you simply, your neighbor might not like you and then accuse you of being an enemy of the people. And then the communist leaders are going to take you away. So that's another problem with this, right? So Ho Chi Minh, though, he's gonna think that democracy needs to be constrained. So he says, do not misunderstand democracy. If no decision has been taken yet, then feel free to discuss. But once a decision has been made, there can be no further debate. Any discussion should only be discussion of how to implement the decision quickly and effectively, not suggestion to not do it. These excessive acts of freedom must be banned. What do you think of that? I mean, doesn't it sound about right, though? Like, if you make a collective decision, no more discussion, you know? You need to make decisions here. That's what democracy is. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm really jogging my brain to figure out what is the perfect solution. If this was like one big game, one big puzzle, you know, how do you make the East and the West system? How do we integrate all these things to make a beautiful society? And I think it's always going to have holes. And I think that there's different stages of these theories that, you know, become rusted. It just becomes rust, like a rust bucket, and you got to repair it.
So here, okay, at this point, now I think I'm ready to talk about what I think might be problems with his theory. So, by the way, there is a lot more to say. Like, he had a lot to say about democracy. Like, after he declares independence on September 2nd, 1945, he says, we're going to have elections soon. And then, you know, and then so he wanted to use democracy to guide the people to kick out the French and then guide the people to communist revolution, essentially. But anyway, so here's number one. One problem is, I think, Ho Chi Minh never made it clear when or if the people would ever grow up and lose their status as undeveloped children in need of guidance, right? So the people are to remain under the guidance of the party forever, essentially. And so this could be frustrating, obviously, to anybody who's seen as just part of the people, right? But then, to counter this, You know, I had mentioned free speech and the lack of free speech and so on. I actually taught a class not too long ago where I asked my students, would you rather live in a country where you have full freedom of speech? You can criticize your government, you can say whatever you want, but it's housing is expensive, education's expensive, it's hard to get access to healthcare, that's expensive. Or would you rather live in a country where healthcare, housing is given to you, secure for you, but you don't have any free speech? What would you choose? Which country would you live in? And you would be surprised.
That sounds very, very much like Singapore, to be honest with you.
And I was just about to say this. I had a student in the class who was from Singapore, and he said, I'm from Singapore, and that's actually the second country that you described. And I would choose that one. He said, I would choose that one. Yeah.
And Lee Kuan Yew really made sure that he got, you know, the housing situation under control. He made sure he got healthcare, education under control. And it was a dictatorship. It was a benevolent dictatorship by one man.
I'm really glad you're bringing up Lee Kuan Yew, because I've been on a kick reading him, watching his speeches. I mean, he is this almost the archetype of the Confucian leader, right? Very, he interferes in your personal life, and he says it's for your own long-term good. And then if you look at Singapore today, you could probably make the argument, yeah, people love him. He's well-respected, right?
Yeah, I mean, look at their society. They did it right. But again, 3 million, 4 million people at the time, a lot easier to manage than 70 million people.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Singapore is, what, 5 million people? Vietnam's 100 million. So, exactly.
I mean, I think at the time Lee Kuan Yew he was actually just 3.5 million or some, right. that was a very low amount at the time. Yeah. And he really was able to manage things. And you know, he's a British educated lawyer. And so he married the Confucian. So I think somehow that might be the closest you can get to a, you know, a good model, which is the Singapore model. We can get into that much later down the road. But
so another problem, a potential problem, by the way, I think all ideologies have problems. Okay, I'm not just singling out Ho Chi Minh's. Second, citizens might choose to refuse their childlike status, right? And so they're going to call for more freedom of speech, more freedom to criticize the government. Now, Ho Chi Minh did urge party leaders to have a flexible and tactful attitude towards all people in all walks of life. I'm quoting him. He says that you have to compromise, you have to respect people's personalities. But at the same time, we have to remember that Ho Chi Minh did use this language of having enemies of the people. And this makes sense for Ho Chi Minh's time, because when he was alive, the Vietnamese quote-unquote people were at war with enemies from France, Japan, United States, and internal. This is from his perspective. Vietnamese collaborators, landlords, capitalists. And so his paternalistic democracy was supposed to be used against enemies. But the problem is that, well, are you ever going to stop having enemies, right? Otherwise, you might hallucinate enemies and become too paranoid. And so this is where other thinkers like Nguyen Minh Doong come in. They have a lot to say about that. So anyway, let me close off my discussion with Ho Chi Minh, then maybe we can discuss more. But Ho Chi Minh would go on to lead the Vietnamese communists through war with the French, through war with the Americans, and the official ideology of the Vietnamese Communist Party today is called Tu Duong Ho Chi Minh, Ho Chi Minh Thought, right? And he has his mausoleum in Hanoi, which, by the way, was built against his own wishes to be cremated. Like, as he was sick, they had the Soviet embalming team come in ready to go, you know. And there's a reason, I think a strategic reason for the Communist Party to do that, because his image, his memory, his legend coheres the nation. It's like the glue. How can young children of new generations know Ho Chi Minh ever existed? Well, build a mausoleum, you know, have this memory to him. So,
yeah, and I think that act of defiance
by his future not predecessors, but the people that went after him, his successors, say a lot about using Ho Chi Minh as a sort of a pawn for their messaging. You know, I think it's a fair thing to say, because even in death, the successors are doing things against Ho Chi Minh's will. And if you think about the idea of cremation, which is like, I'm gone, I'm completely done with this, I'm out, I'm burned down, I'm like, I'm gone.
Have you been there? Sorry, to the mausoleum?
I've driven by many times, but I have.
You've never walked in?
Yeah, I just haven't done it. And it's not anything, you know, I've actually walked by it. I just didn't go in. I mean, it's not any act of defiance or anything or anything. I just, like many things, I just don't, yeah. I eventually, perhaps, but I haven't been in yet. Yeah. So, going back to the successors, I think that in that defiance, there's many things that they did that were probably not in the realm of what Ho Chi Minh wanted. I really believe that. Just like the original popes, I think, were probably on the right track. And then popes of later years have to deal with other things that pop up in their lifetimes that were, you know, that they had to just accept or make rules to, like, do weird things in their control.
Yeah. You had mentioned using Ho Chi Minh as sort of a pawn. And I mean, there's an argument to be made that I've heard that the land reforms of the 1950s, the Communist Party leaders later admitted to making mistakes, to persecuting innocent people, but they had Wang Wenzhap admit to mistakes. He was the one who gave the speech. And I've heard some historians argue that, well, they had Wang Wenzhap take the blame because Ho Chi Minh was not someone who could be seen as making such mistakes. You know, so there is a level of using Ho Chi Minh's image and so on. But one thing that I would say is that you go to Vietnam today, you talk to young Vietnamese people, you ask them how they feel about Ho Chi Minh, there's a real warmth and love that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, just warmth. Did I tell you the story of the young Vietnamese student I met in the Netherlands? I was at a conference a few years ago, and she was from Vietnam, and I was working on my book project, and I asked her, what do you think of Ho Chi Minh? And she just lit up, and she said, oh my gosh, he's such a hero. You know, I sometimes dream of leaving Vietnam one day, traveling around the world, learning, and then coming back to help my country. Like, and she was like, tell me, what book should I read of Ho Chi Minh? It was a real positive emotion here.
Yeah, and I wonder if Americans feel that way about any figure in American history. You know?
Well, I do know a lot of Americans on the left love Ho Chi Minh the same way. I know that for a fact. And same with the Germans. Oh, by the way, this is relevant. I just came back from Vienna. I gave a book talk in Vienna, and I met with a young Vietnamese person who was born and raised in Germany, but her parents came as part of a work program with the Soviet bloc. So they were working in Eastern Germany. So a lot of them, and she was telling me how it wasn't just East Germany. It was also West Germany. Like, a lot of the Germans loved Ho Chi Minh, like the masses of people. Like, you could find video footage of the 1960s where they're protesting against the war. They have Ho Chi Minh's image everywhere. Anyway.
Yeah, and like I said, I think there is a lot of leadership that came after Ho Chi Minh that perhaps did a lot of things different than what Ho Chi Minh. I think maybe in the later twilight years of Ho Chi Minh, he was sort of just this figurehead that, you know, his underlings had to take control and do some very severe things that affected the South government of, you know, we are children that were affected. Our parents were affected. Our parents' parents' generation were affected by the successors of Ho Chi Minh. And I think that the whole group just got a bad rap because of a lot of atrocities that were committed after Ho Chi Minh sort of became more of a figurehead than somebody who is leading the charge on the ground.
Right. So Ho Chi Minh's actual influence in the party would be kind of a wane over the years. You know, he would eventually be sidelined by figures like Lê Duẩn, and Trường Chinh would eventually become the leading theorist and so on. But again, they're going to use his image here.
Yeah, and I really do want to hear more about Lê Duẩn. You know, I think that is somebody that I am very curious, because I think he took the mantle and he grabbed the flag at right after Ho Chi Minh and really made the big decisions for the country after Ho Chi Minh, correct?
Yeah. And also, I mean, Lê Duẩn's death would also mark a big turning point for Vietnamese party politics as well, because that would allow some freeing up to do, pave way for things like Doi Mai and so on.
Wonderful, Kevin. So I think we are probably going to be able to tease out our next episode with probably Lê Duẩn, and we'll counterbalance somebody after Lê Duẩn, because I think we're going hard in the paint with these two figures.
Wait, do we know who we're doing in the next episode?
No, I don't know. I'm making an argument for Lê Duẩn.
No. Oh, really? I thought we were going to do Nguyễn Văn Thiệu.
Well, you're right. That's what we talked about. So we should let's do Nguyễn Văn Thiệu first and then return back to Lê Duẩn. Just so, dear audience, we would love to balance out these viewpoints, and we don't want to lean too heavily one way or the other. And we want to keep things, very fair and balanced.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.